important and needs to be disseminated from sea to shining sea. We hope that many of you will decide that you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, and it's really as simple as picking up the telephone and calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, if you join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, why, you'll get our four best tapes in the month. You'll get our monthly newsletter. And this month, we're dealing with the myth of the Cox Committee Report. And you may find that simply, what do you mean, the myth of the Cox Committee Report? Didn't the Chinese communists steal all of our secrets? I mean, didn't they get the neutron bomb and the secrets for intercontinental missiles and techniques for building all of our various warheads, and aren't our cities in jeopardy of being attacked now by their nuclear-tipped intercontinental ballistic missiles? And that's absolutely true. But, of course, we are not so stupid we didn't know what was happening. And all you need to do is go back and study the history of this last 50 years to find out that communism in Russia and communism in China are a direct result of the financial intervention and actual funding from American capitalists to both Russia and China. And it was the policies of the Council on Foreign Relations-dominated American State Department in the late 1940s that brought communism to China, and have, right now are doing everything they can to continue giving it most favored nation trade status and to build up the best enemy that money can buy. So you really need to get our latest newsletter. It'll give you an entirely different slant and understanding of the unfolding of world events, because, you see, our job is to tell you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, and what you are not getting through the controlled media here in the United States. Joining the Radio Liberty family is just going to your telephone and calling 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or you can certainly write to us at Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063. And if you're one of the people sitting out in the audience saying, gee, things are terrible, what can we do? Let me tell you that there are a lot of exciting things come down the line. I got some of the most exciting news I've had in a long time from Washington, D.C. today, but I'm not at liberty to reveal it to you, but I will tell you within a couple of weeks some of the most exciting news. You're going to have to be listening right here on Radio Liberty, but we'll be on the front lines when this story breaks, if it does break. But what we really need is your help to reach people across America, because indeed our families, our future, our freedom are under attack today. Give us a call at 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. That's 1-800-544-8927. We'd love to welcome you into the Radio Liberty family of supporters. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. James Herson of Trinity College. We're talking about the American Constitution, a subject which is not taught in our schools today, or at least this understanding of it is not taught, because there are those who don't believe in our Constitution, and tragically many of them work within the educational system and are using our educational system to confuse our young people, so they really won't understand the privilege it is to be raised in a nation under God that had its foundation based upon a Christian Republican type of government, unique throughout all history. So, Dr. Herson, why don't you pick up there, and let's go on from there. One other thing I would like to ask you, though, is you were reading Section 2 of the Constitution, and it said, and perhaps I misunderstood, but it said that when you were to be elected as a congressman, you were not to be an inhabitant of that state in which he shall be chosen. When elected, be an inhabitant of that state in which he shall be chosen. What in heaven's name are they talking about?
Yeah, it was the original text said that both in the House and the Senate, who shall not, when elected, be an inhabitant of the state for which he shall be chosen.
Well, what did that mean?
It meant exactly what it said. That,
all right.
They wanted to have individuals from outside the state to be representing for that individual state.
Oh, that explains Hillary becoming
to
represent New York, where she's never lived. All right.
You know, the very first House of Representatives actually had 65 members, and it was one representative for every 30,000 people. And the United States grew, so in 1929, Congress passed a law that limited the number of members of the House of Representatives to 435 members to keep it from becoming too large. So today we have approximately one representative for about 500,000 people. And Section 3, as I was saying, it sets up the Senate of the United States, which is a very important part of our republic because it moves a step away from the idea of the popular vote. And as I said, you know, Alexander Hamilton actually wanted senators to have a lifetime term. Of course, now we have 6 years. But the original Constitution had the Senate chosen by the legislature of each state for 6 years, and therefore, you know, the number of senators is fixed. Now, a later amendment, the 17th, changed this paragraph so that voters in each state, rather than the state legislatures, elected their own senators. Many people have actually criticized that change. You know, here in California, with Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer, we really criticize it, but I suppose with the makeup of our current legislature, we'd still have Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer.
But I think that people need to understand that this was to maintain this Republican form of government so that the people couldn't vote themselves into slavery, and so that the senators would not then be subject to have to raise funds to maintain an their position in office. They were to be selected by the state legislatures, and so you couldn't be bought and sold so readily as you are today. That's really what it's all about.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. That's exactly the reason that the change of the 17th Amendment was very controversial. But of course, that's what we are our current situation is, that the senators are elected by popular vote, just like the members of the House, moving us closer to this kind of pure democracy as opposed to a republic.
Right.
And it talks about the rules of the Senate in this section. Talks about the requirements. An important point that people just need to understand from the point of view of a procedural matter is that the vice president is the president of the Senate and has no vote in the Senate unless they're tied. And that's what the Constitution says. He shall have no vote unless they be equally divided, which is exactly what happened on this gun control measure where Al Gore cast the deciding vote. And that's why it is important which party takes the White House, because the vice president becomes a senator in the case of tie votes. And then a very important part of this Section 3 that was in the news and as part of our current situation is that the Senate has the sole power to try all impeachments. And we saw that trial, and we saw basically a sham trial. Recently, David Shippers, who was the counsel for the House managers, has come forward and said that the Republican senators told him that there was no way, no matter what the evidence was, that this president would be convicted in that trial, which is really means that they're violating what the Constitution says here, that when sitting for that purpose, they, that means the Senate, shall be on oath or affirmation. And this is an oath that historically is an appeal to God to carry out this very, very solemn task. And it states here that when the President of the United States is tried, the Chief Justice shall preside. And we saw that. And no person shall be convicted without the concurrence of two-thirds of the members present. And the Founding Fathers wanted to make impeachment serious and difficult. And so they did put in that two-thirds vote instead of a majority vote. But the Founding Fathers contemplated the integrity of the Senate when they were sitting as jurors, in essence, in a trial like this. And I'm sure the Founding Fathers did not contemplate the kind of lack of integrity and lack of courage that we saw in the Senate during this impeachment process.
And I think that is the most frightening thing today, the fact that we have, for instance, Barbara Boxer, who is related to the Clintons by marriage, not reclusing herself from sitting in judgment on a relative of the family. We saw senators who came out and made public statements ahead of time that Bill Clinton wasn't guilty, before hearing the evidence at all. We have people without moral integrity in government, and as John Adams had said so well, our system of government was made for moral and religious people, and it would not work for any other. And the tragedy is today the total lack of moral integrity on the part of our bought and sold legislators.
Yeah, and it is really, and by the way, we skipped over that one section in the previous thing where the House of Representatives has the sole power of impeachment, and the Senate has the sole power to try all impeachments. And after the House impeached William Jefferson Clinton, we saw that disgraceful little pep rally on the White House lawn where Al Gore said he was one of the greatest presidents in history. And now, of course, Al Gore is saying that he is trying to distance himself from Bill Clinton and saying that his actions were disgraceful, which is quite interesting. But it goes on to say, and this is very relevant to our current situation, judgment in cases of impeachment shall not extend further than to removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States, but the party convicted shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law. And that is what should have happened in this case. And, of course, it could have something to do with so now it's up to 1,200 FBI files that are still in their possession. In 1868, Andrew Johnson was impeached by the House, but in that case, just like William Jefferson Clinton, his trial in the Senate did not result in his conviction and removal because they didn't get the two-thirds vote. And then, of course, in 1974, Richard Nixon resigned before he could be impeached in the House and tried in the Senate. And so Bill Clinton is the third president to have the threat of impeachment and is the second president to actually be impeached. And then this section on the Senate goes on to indicate the kind of procedural manner of holding elections for senators and representatives, that they're prescribed in each state by the legislature, but that the Congress can alter such regulations. And it's interesting that they put in language saying that the Congress shall assemble at least once every year.
Oh boy, I wish it was just assembly, maybe just once every year, and then go home.
Yeah.
We'd be a lot better off.
We really would, and they state the day, the first Monday in December. And then a later amendment, the 20th Amendment, changed the day, but the reason it laid out that the Congress must meet at least once a year is that the kings in Europe had been known to keep their parliaments from meeting for years at a time when the king just wanted no interference from the legislature.
I remember that wonderful line of of Ron Paul, who said that the day that the Congress does the most for the American people is the day of the Republican-Democrat baseball game, whether they're not in session. Or I think it one of our great comedians who said no man's life or purse are safe when Congress is in session. That was Will Rogers.
Yeah, yes. So the government shutdown was really a great gift to the American people.
Raymond.
Yeah. And it talks about, you know, the origin of the congressional record. In here in this section, each house is required to keep a journal of its proceedings, and each house determines the rules of its proceedings and when to punish and that sort of thing. And so we see that still, like when Newt Gingrich was given his punishment, it was pursuant to the rules that are set forth in the House. And the Senate rules on impeachment were used, and Robert Byrd was supposed to be this expert on the Senate rules, even though he seemed to have a spinectomy or something at the last minute on that impeachment process.
He even admitted that the president was obviously guilty, but he had to do what was best for the country.
That's right. And it says, neither house during the session of Congress shall without the consent of the other adjourn for more than 3 days, nor to any other place than that in which the two houses shall be sitting. And that was because the two houses of the British Parliament had quarrels with each other, and if one house adjourned, it would bring Congress to a standstill. So when they're in session, the Constitution wants them both to be in session, because we need both in order to function. And then it talks about, in Section 6, that they're to receive a salary. And, of course, we've seen that salary rise quite a bit. The reason that they put that in there was because members of the British Parliament weren't paid for their services, and poor citizens could not be members of the British Parliament because of that. So the Founding Fathers wanted to allow, particularly in the House, a broad array of people to be able to serve. Unfortunately, the politics of today still make it impossible for poor citizens to serve. And now the salaries are, I think they're, what, about $140,000 or something like that.
Right.
So they're really create a kind of a conflict of interest, because we have people that are career politicians, and they're more concerned about that $140,000 a year than they are in making stands of principle and conscience for the best interest of the American people. And it also talks about privileges. There's an immunity for members of Congress to arrest for certain kinds of crimes, except for treason and felony and things like that. They have the kind of immunity that a diplomat would have while they're in session. I think there have been some congressmen that have used that to avoid traffic tickets. And there's a provision that says that no senator or representative during the time which he was elected be appointed to any civil office under the authority of the United States which shall have been created, or the emoluments, which is gains from employment or position, whereof shall be increased during such time, and no person holding office in the United States shall be a member of either house during its continuance. And without this provision, a member of Congress could create a high-paying job in the federal government, get himself appointed to that job while still a member of Congress. But unfortunately, we have a situation where we allow ex-congressmen to go out and become lobbyists, in many cases, against the interest of the American people. And that's part of campaign finance and areas that we really do need to reform. In Section 7 is a very important section, and that is that this is why one of the main reasons that Congress is supposed to be the most important branch. All bills for raising revenue shall originate in the House of Representatives, but the Senate may propose or concur with amendments as in other bills. So the power of the purse is with Congress and originates in the House. And that is why, for example, when we deal with things like the president going out and engaging and deploying troops in violation of the Constitution or in violation of the War Powers Act, that Congress has the power to defund that. And when executive orders are signed that are illicit, Congress has the power to defund that. If they have the backbone, they have that power. And we have some congressmen that are trying to do those things and that do have the backbone, but the majority of our Congress right now are not meeting up to this mandate that the Founding Fathers gave them. And in this Section 7, it describes something that used to be taught to school children, and that is how a bill becomes law. And it says that every bill, and a bill is basically proposed legislation, that passes in the House of Representatives and the Senate shall, before it become a law, be presented to the President of the United States. And so this bill, the House of Representatives and the Senate pass it, and then the President has the choice of either to approve it and sign it, or to exercise a veto. And a veto is just a rejection of the bill. Like, for example, where President Clinton vetoed the ban on partial birth abortion. Once a bill is vetoed in this section, the Congress can override the veto, can basically negate the president's objection with a two-thirds vote. And at that point, it will become law. And this is part of, again, I think the veto process is part of this idea of the balance of powers, of checks and balances. So the idea that if Congress gets out of hand, that the president can stop Congress, and if the president gets out of hand, Congress can override the president.
And that's really an ingenious system. I noticed that it goes on to say that if you vote on a bill, it's to be recorded by yeas and nays, and yet today so many of the bills are passed by acclamation so that we really can't tell how our congressmen voted. It seems like they're almost afraid that the people will find out that they're the way they're voting.
Yeah, well, that's a very good point, Dr. Stan. These voice votes are taken whenever there's a highly controversial bill and the members of Congress want to hide. Then they take a voice vote. And they sometimes take it in the middle of the night, and they sometimes take it with less than a quorum. And it's very sneaky, is what it comes down to. In most of the colonies before the Revolutionary War, the governors were appointed by the British kings, and they had the power to veto legislation that was proposed by the colonial legislatures. So this was something that was misused, and the representatives didn't have the ability to come back with this two-thirds vote. So the governor's misuse of the veto power, that experience was actually was one of the grievances that led to the revolution, but it also was something that taught the Founding Fathers that they needed this idea of another check and another balance by having this two-thirds vote to come back. And, the biggest, probably the one of the biggest sections of this Article 1 is Section 8. And you mentioned it earlier, Dr. Stan, and that gives the various enumerated powers of Congress. And it's the key thing for Section 8 is this idea of limited government, that there are only these enumerated powers and no others. And that was unfortunately extremely distorted by the Supreme Court in a number of ways. One of the primary ways was the Commerce Clause, and another way was what was called the Necessary and Proper Clause that we can talk about. I can see that we're running short of time, so maybe what we should do is start up on that Section 8 for the next program.
All right, fine, because this really is the key to understanding there were certain things that Congress could do. And then, of course, the 10th Amendment to prevent Congress from interfering the lives of the population was very, very specific in stipulating that the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. In other words, the Bill of Rights really was a restriction on what Congress could do. And it was to prevent Congress from, and the federal government from ever becoming totally regulatory and controlling the lives of the people. Because our founding fathers valued their liberty, it seems that today people are much more concerned about affluence and their 401ks than they are with these abstract ideas of freedom, because freedom really is not important until you've lost it. And then, of course, it becomes your most precious possession.
That's so true. And what you're saying is so true. The amendments, in a sense, are almost redundant, because if you take the Constitution literally, when it says herein granted, and that's why I said the Founding Fathers didn't put the amendments in right away, because the government didn't have the power respecting establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise or abridging freedom of speech. So it already didn't have it, but to make it perfectly clear, they went ahead and added these amendments, and we get no rights from the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. Our rights are already with us. What we're setting forth in the Constitution and Bill of Rights is what the government cannot do. And it's interesting you mentioned the Tenth Amendment. The Ninth Amendment talks about the rights, enumeration of rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage those retained by the people, the sovereignty of the people. And then the Tenth Amendment talks about the sovereignty of the state and mentions the people again. So we have start with we the people. We have the Declaration of Independence saying that we have these unalienable rights and powers that come from the divine source. And then we have the people mentioned twice again in the Bill of Rights, the Ninth and Tenth Amendment.
Well, we're out of time. We're really looking forward to it. We'll be doing this next week at the same time. So thank you so very much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Stan. It's my pleasure. I look forward to it as well. God bless you.
And you too. Bye-bye. Well, our guest this evening has been Dr. James Herson, professor of law at Trinity College. And you've had a great lesson in the Constitution. I hope you'll get your Constitution out, reread it, and then think about the preamble where the people who created the United States talked about providing for the common defense, but promote the general welfare. We were never to provide for the general welfare. That was to be a function of the state and the local community, because a government that can provide for people must be able to control the people, and any government that can provide for you from the cradle to the grave must control you from the cradle to the grave. This is one of the most greatest documents ever written. Go back, reread the preamble of the Constitution, read up to Section 8, and we'll be back with that next week. And so, don't even think about changing that dial. We're coming back with another great program here in just a couple of moments.